Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
I just felt like it was a little bit of a kick in the balls, to be honest.
It came a lot sooner than I thought that I would be the oldest player on the team.
That's all you got, brother. That's all you got.
The word of the day would have been hyper-realism.
We're bad at soccer, but we're good on a bagel.
Boarding the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rapids and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Home.
Hey, Colorado Rapids fans, I'm walking here! You're listening to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. It is Monday, May 6th, 2024. Happy return of the 6th. May your favorite defensive midfielder be with you always. Welcome to Wrexham Season 3 is officially underway. The Premier League title may come down to the hands of Everton and Fulham as Arsenal and Manchester City battle for the title. Tim Howard is officially a U.S. Soccer Hall of Famer, and your Colorado Rapids went into Citi Field on Sunday afternoon and turned New York burgundy and blue. Joining me now to discuss Rapid Man or Bear, among many other things, the Obi-Wan Kenobi to my Luke Skywalker, Rabbi Mark Goodman.
We debated very hotly which characters we should be, and I preferred to like come up with... I preferred being Sith or Han Solo-type characters, or even... I even suggested being Jar Jar Binks in this analogy, and Matt was really upset with the suggestion that we would have to pair anything off of Jar Jar Binks, which actually begs the question, like, does anything pair with Jar Jar Binks? I mean, I think it's Queen Amidala is kind of her best bud, but maybe it's Obi-Wan. It's hard to say. Or like who's the Gungan king?
What's that Boss dude's name? Nass. The,
Boss yeah. Nass. Boss
Jar Jar,
Nass.
You in big doo-doo now, and he does the
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Matt, good knowledge of episode one. I don't know, actually, if you look
it's
back
the
on
first
it,
Star Wars movie I saw in theaters, Mark. Remember, well, I'm younger than you.
That's funny. Do you know which my first movie was?
Was it in also theaters? Phantom Menace?
No. My first movie in the theater was episode 6 with my mom when I was 8 years old. So, 1984. I remember it. I think that might have been one of my first movies in a theater, which you cannot go wrong with Return of the Jedi as your one of your first all-time movies. In Westwood, L.A., no doubt. Long line. I remember it really, really well. It's a lot of fun. So,
Had you seen the previous episodes as well, Mark? Were you aware of what was going on in the rest of the Star Wars universe?
So, I remember, I mean, the action figures were a big deal. The Mattel action figures, you know? But I'll tell you this, my earliest Star Wars memory was, I don't remember, I'm sure because the internet allowed, the internet has everything on it. There was an Empire Strikes Back radio play that was on the radio when I was a kid. And when I was like 7, I remember listening to it on the way home from like my grandmother's house on a Saturday or something like that. And like, it was one of those like, sit in the driveway, not leave kind of moments. We sat in the driveway for 45 minutes and listened to the Empire Strikes Back radio play. And it was rad. It was so, so good. So anyhow.
Mark, so May 6th is, of course, a Star Wars holiday to the extent that there are Star Wars holidays. I don't know what canonically what calendar date were the two Battle of the Two Death Stars. But in any case, Mark, we can co-opt May the 6th to be, you know, have it be Return of the Sixth as opposed to Return of the Jedi, and then turn that into, of course, Cheers to the Sixth. So we're going to do a very, very rare thing here, listeners. The overwhelming majority of episodes you've heard from Holding the High Line, Mark is maybe casually sipping one drink as we're doing it, but we're actually both going to have one on top of the fact that we're celebrating, Mark, a fantastic state of the Colorado Rapids. So tell our dear listeners what they are what you are drinking as I give them some ASMR, me pouring my beer as we get to the football.
In my Holding the High Line pint glass, I am drinking a glass of Oscar Blues Brewery Death by Flapjacks, and it is ale with maple syrup, vanilla, lemon peel, nutmeg, lactose, and natural flavors. The maple syrup comes through strongly. The vanilla, there's a hint of it. It's kind of hard to taste, kind of like, because it's like a, it's a grainy, weedy thing. Like, you can kind of pick up the pancakiness of the whole thing, but overall. And Matt, tell our listeners what you're drinking, what you're pouring into the glass.
Yes, I hope you got some of that sound there, listeners. I hopefully. I'm drinking a Denver Beer Company graham cracker peanut butter porter, Mark, 12 ounce out of the can. I will admit, got a decent amount of foam head here, so I might have to wait a couple minutes for that to pour. This thing takes about as long as, say, a Guinness or maybe that milk stout nitro. So nice. I'll be joining you shortly, Mark.
Representing
actually
Colorado, because Oscar Blues is brewed in Longmont.
Yes.
So represent. And then I also went out and got a six pack of Shinerbach tonight. So, but I wanted the gimmick beers tonight. So
yes. So Rabbi, Bruce. I think officially after yesterday's performance at time of recording, I think we can officially call Oliver LaRaza six, or at least capable of being a six. We will not call him yet a Jeff Lerwinowitz Ginger Ninja, but Oliver LaRaza is the six who I am cheering to. Mark, who are you cheersing to with your maple syrupy beer?
I'll cheer to the other six, if you go onto the Twitter machine, you'll find that there's a hot debate about whether Cole Bassett is one of the best midfielders in Major League Soccer this year. Someone called him the second best midfielder statistically in Major League Soccer this year, which is like, that is a strong statement. We're talking defensive midfielders.
Okay, I was going to say.
Central and defensive midfielders, not including attacking mids. But yeah, and it's a strong statement, but I think it's probably a topic for another time or a good HTHL down the road, but like asking the question, like, what does Cole need to do to work himself into kind of real contention for the national team? I know the depth at midfield is deep, but he feels like kind of like, you know, we've been talking about, I remember at the beginning of the season, the Apple TV talking points for the Colorado Rapids over and over and again were Zach Steffen and Sam Vines and Georgi Mihailovic are trying to work their way back into the national team setup. And I was like, could you please stop saying that and find another angle on this team? Because we're a fascinating soccer team, and what you just said is not that interesting. So I'm going to spin out the maybe Cole Bassett is the six that we all need to be cheering to for the possibility that maybe he's the guy. Maybe he is working his way into the national team setup.
He absolutely should be on the squad for the Olympics at this point, Mark, but I feel like we both have been in agreement for that. But so, Rabbi, let's talk about it. One of the soccer cultural icons, soccer cultural things that we have there in the American footy space right now, of course, is Welcome to Wrexham, which has grown in prominence due to the quality of the docuseries, the nature of the story, and then obviously the underlying what's happening as we see, you know, two Hollywood celebrities elevate a, you know, National League now into the Football League, English Welsh football club. And so we've got an interesting situation here, folks. So the season three actually kicked off last week. Mark watched the first episode. I haven't watched the first episode. And as we talked about before hitting the record button, Mark is actually watching this in the dark. I had apparently the notifications on my phone, and I was keeping up with the actual wins and losses and where Wrexham was in the table. So I know what happens in the season that just finished for Wrexham 2023-2024, which is covered in season three, but I have not actually seen an episode of season three to come out. But so, Mark, our thoughts on the state of Welcome to Wrexham. Are we getting to the point where the football club is potentially outgrowing the need for the docuseries, to the point where the has fandom of the documentary converted enough people into fandom of the club, thus making the docuseries a more of a season review behind the scenes rather than actually watching it for the drama, because we've already known what's happened. And how butthurt should MLS fans be that a team in the middle of nowhere, Wales, that is in the fourth tier, nowhere close to the Premier League, continues to suck up oxygen and attention in the room that is potentially curtailing MLS's growth domestically?
I'll tweak the question. I did an article a couple months ago during the summer when, or during the winter when we were all kind of like waiting for the season to kick off again, which was about like, and Matt and I both love to do these kinds of articles because we've both done them, like a here's what I'm watching and what I think is good on TV about soccer that you should be watching while we're all waiting for soccer to come back. Or I've actually written those articles during the Colorado Rapids season when they were so far out of things that watching reality television was more enjoyable than watching the Colorado Rapids. My take on the Wrexham series, Matt, is a twist on what you said, which is what's great about it is I think it should keep going is the quick answer. I don't think it's outgrown. I don't think the team's success has outgrown the documentary, because I think what the documentary did was elevate the brand of team-focused documentaries that was out there. I thought Sunderland was a really good start to that, but Sunderland had kind of a gritty, grim reality behind the scenes gotcha aspect to it that didn't have the kind of upbeat whimsicalness that happens when you've got Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney kind of behind the scenes working the thing. I think the thing that Wrexham has done is force these behind the scenes documentaries that are the NFL one from HBO, Hard Knocks, was kind of like the original.
Yeah.
L'chaim to you, Matt. And he's taking a sip. Hard Knocks is interesting because it did a really nice job of like delving into individual personalities. It was very focused on preseason and the draft, and it did really good things like that and really kind of did a nice job spotlighting things. But then there's been some series since that have been kind of like, you know, they're not really behind the scenes. They're very manufactured by the club. The one about Arsenal, the one about Manchester City, like a lot of these that have been on Amazon and on ESPN were like, it's not all access. They're trying to spin it in a way that looks best for the team. And like Wrexham definitely is doing that a little bit, but like that's also because it is, you know, a really kind of heartwarming story. It's not a juggernaut team like Manchester City. So I think the fact that like it's creating a new lane and avenue for these kinds of documentaries, I think it's elevating and complicating the nature of what a documentary should look like. I think, by the way, speaking of which, and this is, I'll sign off on this one. I think that's actually something that's been missing in the Apple coverage, which is, excuse me, they did a thing on like Messi coming to the league, and it was, you know, a lot of what you, Matt, you're muted, but they Matt wants
league propaganda. It was insider. It was fine and everything.
Right.
But, like, it wasn't. Wrexham shows the warts. Sunderland Till I Die showed the warts on some level.
Be real. It's real. It's not sanitized. And so I think that's the other thing is that like league, I think that's one of the challenges. And this is a conversation that we're having over at the Pittsburgh Soccer website, which is like, The thing that team-based media, league-based media, and independent media are all kind of doing differently is, like, independent media doesn't care about your feelings, you know? When Matt and I write an article, if the team was bad, we're going to write, they were bad, right? Like, the Colorado Rapids are never going to write, our team was bad! You know, like, that's not the social media message, and MLS is never going to really write that. So being a little bit more objective in your coverage while also being behind the scenes is one of the aspects of Wrexham.
Yeah, I think to your point, Mark, I wish we had recorded our conversation before pod so I could show like my exasperation at you somehow avoiding the somehow avoiding the spoilers. I think you'd have to, you know, you'd have to have them off Fop Mob. You'd have to skip a couple episodes of Men in Blazers, because I know they have one of their sub-series within the Men in Blazers podcast feed that is specifically This Week in Wrexham that's catching up. Wow. But I think increasingly it's like, it's been as hard for me, Mark, to stay away from some of the spoilers or what's going on with Wrexham as someone who doesn't watch every single game around the team. You know, it's the level of like trying to avoid Ted Lasso, or not quite like Game of Thrones spoilers. You know, like if I didn't watch Game of Thrones on Sunday night and I had to go to the office on Monday, every single person who I ran into in the office in the before times, I had to say, I haven't seen the latest episode. And I basically couldn't go on social media until I got home and finally watched that, the episode that was on Sunday, watching it, you know, on Monday evening. So I think that the question I would have, Mark, based on what we've seen in terms of fandom, I'd love to know the metrics on how much Welcome to Wrexham or Wrexham AFC has grown in terms of social media following, what percentage of, you know, ticket sales they've gotten from people outside the country, let's just say outside the British Isles. You know, I know there was the bar owner of Turf whatever said that, you know, they're getting several dozen foreigners every single day. You know, they're coming from Asia, they're getting a good number of Americans, they're getting Australians and everything. What percentage of the racecourse ground this coming year, 2024-2025, will be filled with ticket sales from people whose primary residence is outside of the British Isles? That's a fascinating number that I would love to know, and I would love to see track as well. Because if you look at it, Mark, the two Manchester teams, you're looking at about 15,000 to 20,000 tickets that are sold from people that are flying in there specifically for that game. I'd have to imagine some of the English clubs you're getting there. Arsenal probably gets a good number. I'm not sure about Chelsea, given the number of season ticket holders they have relative to the size of Stamford Bridge. I have to believe with the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium from a couple of years ago, Mark, with them expanding from, I think, Old White Hart Lane was 30, 35, 40,000 to well over 60,000. You know, that a good number of those are coming from outside as well. But at what point does Wrexham hit critical mass to where the fandom from outside the country financially or in numbers supersedes what the local base is? And at what point then do Rob and Ryan take into account that from a financial standpoint? Because I don't know if you, since you haven't been paying attention to where they are in the league, Mark, I won't spoil for you what happened in 2023-2024, but it's been well reported that financially that, you know, that Wrexham is getting close to, or was getting close to, being relevant for financial fair play numbers. Now that is taking into account their window, which was in the National League, in which their numbers were significantly lower. And obviously just getting into the Football League increases the TV revenue and the other shared revenue mechanisms that exist prior to that. But Mark, I think we can agree, Rob and Ryan do not have get this team into the Premier League money. I think their ceiling right now at current ownership is probably plucky bottom third of the Championship, which would be a massive improvement from where this club was before then as well. But I wonder at which point the inertia of wanting to tell the story of this plucky underdog and this small little football club, and, you know, the dad who's struggling with potential alcoholism and being a painter and everything, and all these, and the songwriter or the guitarist who has the medical condition, all the nice little people who've become celebrities, not just Paul Mullen. At what point does the desire to tell their story then grow the interest in it to the point where it overtakes that? Like, I have to imagine, Mark, on some level, like the old school Manchester City fans, like, are they glad that they have all the money in the world? Are they glad that they're winning trophies and everything? Yeah, but at the same time, like, it's not their club anymore. The fight and the appeal, or the pull that the local fan had when they were playing in the second division on Old Main Road, compared to the relevancy from where the club is now financially and just the nature of the ownership, has changed. And I wonder if they think that's been sanitized. Can Rob and Ryan continue to grow Wrexham AFC to the point where it still has that local tight-knit feel and everything, has all the financial benefits that then be put in to further save the town? At what point, Mark, does Wrexham exist long enough as the hero or the plucky underdog to become the annoying hated villain or become a villain in that way. Because yes, they were an underdog in terms of the city and everything. They were spending way more money in League Two than anybody else. And is there a point where they become too big for their britches to the point where it's like, okay, like, yes, we're annoyed. Yes, you are a representation of growing up, the football league and everything, but like, we're all kind of annoyed by you. You can kind of go away, or we want to root against you because like, you've almost gotten so big and everything. You know, England is the type of country, Mark, to where if you have a choice, Men in Blazers talks about this all the time, where if you had a choice between something good happening to you and something bad but not terrible happening to your neighbor, you have enough schadenfreude to where you want that, Mark. Like, does the Tottenham fan would rather miss out on top four if it meant that Arsenal didn't win the league than them getting into Champions League if something good happened to Arsenal? And so at what point does Wrexham become so annoying in their goodness or the appeal and the niceness of them that like it gets overblown? You know, like if the Chiefs keep winning, Mark, and they eventually win the Super Bowl, there are a bunch more people who are going to be way more annoyed at Taylor Swift being happy at her boyfriend, potential future husband, having success, because there's a bunch of Swifties who potentially are going to win two Super Bowls in their first 2 years caring about the NFL, and there's a bunch of Broncos fans who potentially have only been alive for one Super Bowl and have seen their team miss the playoffs 6 years in a row. So we'll see how it happens. To your point, Mark, as long as the documentary continues to be good and well done and that like Ted Lasso style wholesomeness about it, then I will continue to watch it and I will continue to get some joy out of it. How do they keep things interesting without just being a repetitive thing? Because, you know, I'm not going to watch, you know, Mark, I'm not going to get the DVD of Fulham's, year in review because I've gotten them for so many years and I watched the whole season. So how do you continue to create novelty over that? I think is a really good production question. And the question I've had from the start of Welcome to Wrexham, Mark, was fundamentally, did Rob McElhenney want to buy a football club so that he could do a documentary because he really likes Sooner Until I Die? Or did he buy it because he wanted to be what the Glazers haven't been, what Shad Khan has been to Fulham, what I don't know who's a good ownership, what Arthur Blank is trying to be to Atlanta United? And now we're getting into the point where it's gone on long enough and it's going to become more financially cumbersome to maintain this monster to where we're going to see where their intention is. And maybe there's a point where they sell off Wrexham because they know it's capable of creating so much more and they need more investment in order to achieve, you know, their Premier League and Champions League. And, you know, Wrexham's a living version of that person who takes, you know, a bottom team in Football Manager or FIFA and takes them up, and in 10, 15 seasons, they're winning Champions League. Mark, shall we move on to the actual soccer?
Well, our actual soccer team, we're talking about soccer. We're just talking about a Welsh team in the fourth division of English soccer.
Okay.
Or at least, so, as far as I know, they're still in the fourth division.
I'm not going to spoil it, Mark. I'm going to let you see.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Okay. So listeners, this past Sunday, May the 5th, Revenge of the 5th, it was revenge of the former New York Red Bulls players as the Colorado Rapids went into Citi Field against New York City FC and got a 2-0 victory. A bit of a lineup change here, Mark. We saw Chris Armas roll out a flat 4-4-2 that at times in transition was a Red Bullsian like 4-2-2-2. The back line was unchanged. Lamine Diak again was a substitute in this match, so we saw Oliver Larraz and Cole Bassett in the holding midfielder roles. Kevin Cabral on the left, Omir Fernandez at the right, and sometimes underneath doing some link-up play, Mark, in that 4-2-2-2. And it was Rafael Navajo and Darren Yapi who were up top as well. And let me make sure, Jasper Lofelsen was on the bench for this game, Mark. I don't remember anybody else. Oh, Adam Beaudry was there as well, Rabbi. I know you saw that, you were a bit surprised. I think maybe in hindsight, Mark, the reporting about that was a little bit delayed, in that by the time Bogert reported that Beaudry was going to London, it was because he was already in London working with Arsenal. And it turns out that stint was only like 10 or 11 days, Mark. So he was at open training on Friday. Oh, I completely forgot, Mark. We should shout out the club for doing the open training. Rabbi, I know you weren't able to make it because geography, but I was there. If we're believing what I was told by a club official, you did have to go through the turnstiles and an abbreviated version of security, Mark. So in theory, they were tracking numbers. There were 415 people reportedly at that open training. There was some media availability stuff, which was absolutely fantastic. And Mark, it seemed like a good time. The players came over. They did some giveaways. They signed some shirts and everything. Judgmental Jim got his Bombi shirt signed by Moist Bombito. Shout out to Clay as well, Mark, an HTHLer who I had met previously in the past wanted to give a shout out on the podcast, but forgot his name in the moment to shout out to Clay, who I got to be able to see. The Rapids should do that again. In any case, Mark, I saw that Adam Beaudry was at training then, so I was like, okay, he's probably going to be on the bench. And we did have a major absence in this lineup, listeners, as Georgi Mihailovic was listed as out with a heel injury, and I suspect that may have been something sustained against FC Cincinnati. He was limited a bit in training when I was there on Tuesday, and Mark, it became very obvious when they set up at the end of the year for set pieces and had the set piece corner moved up because of the narrower pitch at Citi Field, and it was Ollie Larraz taking the corners with Georgi Mihailovic sitting off to the side and looking at stuff. But so, Mark, I thought it was a lively game, a bit of a game of two halves, where I thought fundamentally it was NYCFC with most of the ball, and in the first half, the Rapids did what they want from a pressing and then creating transition moment standpoint, and in the second half, it was more Colorado on their back heels a little bit more. But in the 16th minute, we have the Colorado Rapids open up the scoring, a fantastic sequence that saw Moise Bombito win the ball, play out to Kevin Cabral, who was really good in transition link-up play, folks, and then he got the ball to Cole Bassett, who tried to cross it to the back post, and Rafael Navajo with a very measured moment of taking the ball down, taking a touch to set up his angle, waiting for his time and everything, and just burying it in the far top corner. Mark, it took 1,560 minutes roughly for Navajo to get his first goal from the run of play, and from that point to this getting his second goal from the run of play only took 260 minutes, fifth goal in the season for one Rafael Navajo. The Rapids have a bunch of other chances as well, Mark. Darren Yapi had an opportunity. Kevin Cabral had a spin-around shot that unfortunately went straight at Max Fries. They had a couple corners that didn't really have anything kind of come off, but the Rapids were energetic and were intense, and in particular were very solid from a quality and execution standpoint, especially in that first half. And whatever went wrong in terms of gap control, in terms of pressing, and in terms of intensity to create and execute on transition moments in that game against FC Cincinnati, they completely corrected against that in this game against New York City FC. NYCFC were not without their opportunities, Mark. You had Santi Rodriguez with two big opportunities, one that he skied over the bar. There was one early in the second half that Zach Steffen got a touch to, but I think that one was going wide, even if Zach didn't get a touch to it. And then Bakrar had a really good opportunity, Mark, in the 35th minute. Excuse me, in the 28th. I don't have it here. Maybe I have it wrong. In the I think it was right before, it was in the 45th, excuse me, where Wolf kind of threaded the ball to him and he appeared to have space, but Moise Bombito was able to catch up to him and then block the opportunity there. Mark, this was a very good game for the Rapids defense in that there were moments that they were able to prevent NYCFC via their pressing. And when that didn't work, the emergency defending was very, very solid. Even when NYCFC got into good areas, it looked like the Rapids had things controlled. And Moise Bombito, the shaman of the Burgundy Forest, if you will, was absolutely the leader in that regard. A bit more open in the second half, Mark. Omer Fernandez had an opportunity. There was that Kevin Cabral chance on the counter with, I think, 10 minutes to go that Calvin Harris set him up for it, and he shot it, you know, wide of the far post. Santi Rodriguez gets some opportunities. Bakrar gets some opportunities. Biggest chance for me for the game for NYCFC came in the 77th minute, and that was Jones, who had that thumping header at the back post on that long cross from midfield that he put wide of the far post. And that, Mark, was maybe the one real opportunity I look at it to where NYCFC had an opportunity in which a Rapids player did not close things down. Waning minutes, and ultimately it looked like it was going to come down to both teams getting one really good chance and whether or not they were going to finish it. And spoiler alert, it was the Colorado Rapids. 87th minute, battle for the ball in midfield. Cole Bassett follows up, is able to win the ball from Keaton Parks. He dribbles forward, plays a wonderful 1-2 with Calvin Harris. They've had a great chemistry lately, and Cole buries it emphatically, Mark, far bottom corner. He seems to like that bottom right-hand corner when he's shooting off his right foot. Believe that's the corner he finished on against Yarbrough in the San Jose Earthquakes game. But Mark, the Colorado Rapids get out with a 2-0 win. Fantastic team performance, a great way to bounce back against with the FC Cincinnati game. You had Rafael Navajo with his fifth goal, Cole Bassett scoring his fourth as well. Mark, that was the fifth win of the season for the Colorado Rapids. Rabbi, fun trivia question. How many games did the Rapids win in league play in 2023?
I feel like it's a leading question, counselor. I'm going to guess 5. Yes. So we are one third of the way through the 2024 MLS season mark, and the Colorado Rapids have already equaled last year's win total and last year's road win total. Rabbi Mark Goodman, what was your good thing from this pastrami on rye demolition of NYCFC?
Oh my God, what a great turn of phrase, Matt. Did you just make that up on the fly? That was brilliant. I love that.
Maybe the beer's flowing and we haven't gotten to the point mark where my brain is going faster than my mouth and I just stumble over my words.
Oh my God, he didn't write that out in advance. That's the kind of thing that like color commentators write as like, I gotta slip this in at some point. Like, anyhow, this game was interesting to me because I don't think there was a lot separating the two teams. I was just looking at the statistics, and from my eye, this was a very even game. Like, both teams had good chances on the goal. They both had good possession. They fought for it well in the middle third of the park. And the Colorado Rapids had a few lucky breaks, and NYCFC kind of like missed their chances. And that's my basic overly. This game wasn't particularly unique, or it won't stand out. I won't remember it in 2 or 3 years because, not because the Rapids didn't play well. They played very well. They played very solidly. But I think there's an alternate universe where this game comes out 1-1 or 2-2 or 2-1 or 2-0 to New York, because they didn't do a great job finishing their chances. There were, I think, a pair of headed opportunities where New York City had a really nice opportunity to put one in the back of the net and just did not finish. That being said, like, for Colorado to go in and play with confidence and play on the front foot and play well and get result is fantastic. Statistically speaking, if you look at the game, it does not look like an even match. The Rapids were outpassed almost 2-1 in terms of number of passes. The Rapids passing accuracy was only 68%. They were kind of pinned. They conceded possession to New York City a ton. That almost always happens after you take a lead. It especially happens when you take a lead on the road. But the New York City FC outpossessed the Rapids 67-33. In terms of expected goals, New York City had twice as many expected goals than the Rapids. So statistically, it does not look like an even match. It looks like the Rapids got lucky, got out of town easily, and so on. So, but that being said, I felt like the team put in a good shift, did a good job, and I think I would have been happy with a draw based on how they played and got out lucky based on what happened. Matt, your thoughts?
I will push back slightly, Mark, on the stats that you have. We both prefer Fought Mob, Matt, Mark, so we'll looking at those. So, for example, possession numbers right now, 67% to 33% in favor of NYCFC. The expected goals, 1.26 for City, 0.63 for the Rapids. Total shots, 16-9. Big chances, 1-0. I have to assume that big chance was the Jones header in the 77th minute, and then let me see what else that we have, Mark. Corners were 4-3, so that was roughly even. I think we have to take into account, Rabbi, that when the road team scores 16 minutes into the game and has a tactical shift that is inherently defensive or gained on being a little bit more compact, you are going to see the home team down a goal, really push and try to and get back into the game. And I think at that point, Mark, the actions and the decisions that you make, they're going to be a little bit more shot happy. They're thinking, oh, like we have to get a goal. We have to get back into this game. So we are going to shoot in when we have fewer opportunities. And so in that regard, Mark, yes, NYCFC had more of the ball. Yes, they had more shots, but, you know, other than the Jones opportunity and maybe the two opportunities that Santi Rodriguez had, or there was the O'Toole header, and it was a good opportunity, but he headed it straight to Zach Steffen in a corner on the first half. And there was never a big opportunity, Mark, that were like they absolutely should have scored on that, with the exception of the Jones header for me. Had Santi Rodriguez scored on either of his opportunities, you would have said, oh my God, fantastic goal, you know, competition for goal of the week, you know, assuming that, you know, we're not giving votes to any one of the 34 assists that Lionel Messi had to Luis Suarez against New York Red Bulls. I can't believe we didn't start the show by talking about that.
Yes, I started him for my captain. I captained him in MLS Fantasy Mark, and I won all of my games because Lionel Messi. So I push back in a little bit that numbers never lie, Mark, but they don't always tell the full story. And so yeah, understandably, you are going to have a team taking shots that they otherwise wouldn't when it's a level game and they're trying to get a goal, when there's a level of desperation, particularly against an opponent. And we'll talk about this in a little bit when I get to Chris Armas's tactics that were set up to be compact and were to absorb pressure, but force NYCFC into, it was to take away the best thing that they could do with Santi Rodriguez and then Bakar up top and give them the less good opportunity. You know, a shot from outside the box, Mark, from one of their attackers who's not one of the dangerous guys that you want to worry about. You know, shot attempts are one thing, but a shot from Kevin Cabral from 40 yards out and a tap-in opportunity for Georgi Mihailovic or Cole Bassett are not the same opportunity. And so if I just look at Fat Mob as well, and I look at shooting opportunities inside the box, I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, so it's 9 for NYCFC, but then it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for Colorado. And again, that was with NYCFC really chasing the game. Let's highlight some individuals here, Rabbi. Mark, I'm struggling to say whether or not this is Moise Bombito's best game for the Colorado Rapids because he's had so many, but I'll put it this way. Cole Bassett was great in the midfield. Oliver Larraz was great in the midfield defensively. Rafael Navajo unquestionably scored his best and most technically difficult goal for the Colorado Rapids. Mark, there is no question in my mind that Moise Bombito was the man of the match in this game. Agreed?
He had a great game. There's no doubt about it. For me, it was Cole Bassett. I mean, I thought Cole Bassett's contribution on Navajo's goal and then the way he scored his the second goal to kind of ice it, but I just generally think that his possession, but that's me. I also think I picked Bombito for man of the match in San Jose, so for me it's a little bit about like more like can I love this man anymore, can I pick him out as my favorite anymore.
We should cherish him, Mark, because if he keeps doing stuff like this and he works his way into getting minutes for Copa America, I'm not sure he's with the Rapids this time next year.
Cheers to the threes and fours. Although yes. That's ostensibly the number that has been assigned to center backs.
Yeah, so in addition, Mark, to the goal that Navajo scored, that was him creating an opportunity really on his own. Like, good work for Cole Bassett to get him into the area, but the difference that made that goal happen was in Navajo's finish and how he set it up to find the angle to then pick out the far top corner on Matt Freeze, who's a really good goalkeeper in Major League Soccer. And as much, Mark, as we want to praise what Cole Bassett did from an attacking standpoint, or let me say one more thing about Navajo. I thought his hold up play was excellent, Mark, on a more narrow pitch where I think at times he had to travel more into unfamiliar spaces in the field in order to find the game and get the ball. His hold up play to then allow to waste time, keep the ball away from NYCFC, and then get the ball to others to then play out and use that little bit of open space that was available, I thought was really, really good. And so we said that before, it's further accented by the fact that he also scored a fantastic goal. We talked about Bassett, so I won't say anything more on that, Mark, but you know, I thought he and Ollie Larraz did a really good job in terms of understanding when to be more compact and really protect that back line. And I thought Ollie Larraz was fantastic defensively. So, yes, Bombito made some fantastic last-ditch efforts. But, you know, Andreas Maxu was very active defensively. Clearances, blocks, interceptions. And then, whereas there were issues for the two goals conceded against Cincinnati, where there was a gap between the midfield line and the back line, where all of the Roz and Cole Bassett were chasing to get caught up, every single time Colorado was remotely under pressure, those two players were there in the vicinity to ultimately help out and relieve pressure and make that easier. So yes, NYCFC got the ball into good areas, Mark, but what did they ultimately end up doing? It was Santi Rodriguez passing the ball, trying to find Bakrar or the other striker or Jones to come in, and Moise Bondito and Andreas Maxu were there, and if they didn't clear the ball on their own, who was there right there to pick up the loose ball? Oliver Larraz, Cole Bassett. And then, Mark, I don't know if you saw on the call as well, Callum Williams and Kalen Carr were doing the call. I really like them as a duo, Mark, and we haven't gotten them enough on Rapids games. I think they may be more Eastern Conference teams focused, which is maybe why they were.
I watched one of the Houston games earlier, and Kalen Carr usually picks up a Houston game as a former Houston Dynamo player, and I think he's really grown into it. I don't think 4 years ago I would have said the same about Kalen Carr, but I think he's doing a great job. And I also think he's better as a color commentator than he was on Extra Time. So I really enjoy him specifically. Fun fact, I met Kalen Carr once. He's one of the few MLS guys that I met in person because he was covering the 2016 Rapids Seattle game. And I was in the elevator and I said, "Aren't you Kalen Carr?" And he was with, I don't think she's broadcasting for MLS anymore, but there was a woman.
Ariel Castillo?
No, I never met
Susanna Collins.
Susanna Collins was in the elevator, and she was really lovely and very, very nice, and I don't know what's going on with her. Oh, well, anyways.
In any case, Mark, so Callum Williams had a call where NYCFC was trying to push forward, and somebody tried to pass a ball, and it was a little bit hopeful trying to get to somebody, and the Rapids defense just absolutely swallowed it up, won the ball back, and then got the ball going the other way. And I don't remember who made that play on the call in that particular moment. I think it was Moise Bombito, but I'm not entirely sure. But in any case, Mark, he called it, and so-and-so runs into a Burgundy Forest. And so I think about two really tall center backs, Mark. Moise is from Canada. Canada has a lot of forests. Scandinavia is known for its nature as well. I guess we can throw in Keegan Rosenberry, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania. Mark has a lot of trees if we're talking about Keegan Rosenberry. And Sam Vines, who, Pike National Forest, maybe not as woodsy as some of the other areas. But so Burgundy Forest, Mark, I think we need an appropriate... I think that would be a good nickname for this defense right now, given their height and their prowess in the air on both sides. Mark, shall we officially christen? Do we want to make Fetch Burgundy Forest a thing?
I don't know. I'm trying to come up with something. I don't have anything better, but the problem with that is Rosenberry and Vines aren't tall, so I don't know that quite fits. But
he's 5'10", I think, and he's got some hops, Mark.
I'm 5'10". I don't think nobody looks at me and goes, "Wow, you're tall." That being said, the senior rabbi at the synagogue I work at is 6'5", so I'm not tall compared to anybody.
Keegan Rosenberry listed as 5'8". I apologize. And then Sam Vines. In that case, I'm even more impressed with Keegan's vert. Sam
and
Vines,
I'm more impressed with me being 5'8", or 5'10".
Then you are the same height as one Sam Vines. Mark, any more good things, or shall we transition to bad thing?
I mean, I don't really have any bad thing, to be honest. I mean, I think that this team had about as good a game as they could have. I think my only concern, bad thing wise, is that they were a little lucky. That I think that they got out of Dodge with a lucky break, because I think this game probably should have been a 2-2 draw, and that would have been fine because I thought NYCFC was a very good team, and a road draw is great. We didn't get a road draw. We got a dominant road win. A semi-accidental dominant road win. Matt, what were your bad things?
Sam Vines, Mark, has yet to impress me offensively with what he's doing. And I'm wondering how much of that is him trying to get resettled or getting used to MLS, or maybe something he's working through that went back to his form and his injuries when he was in Belgium, or just, as we've seen generally from a Red Bull standpoint, but in particularly, Chris Sarmis does not like to have as overlapping fullbacks. And where Sam Vines was at his best, both under Robin Fraser with the Rapids first team, and then also with the national team at that Gold Cup call-up and the other call-ups that he's gotten under Greg Berhalter, is being the Vines back position that you wrote that, wonderful back pass article on about that new and unique position that we just haven't seen him play. And is that something going on with Sam, or is that something in terms of just the tactics? And in that regard, is Sam maybe, a rhombus? Is Sam a slightly... Is he not a not quite square peg being fit into a perfectly square hole? I am wondering. And so you compile that, Mark, with, I think, him being not as solid defensively. We've seen other games. I remember San Jose. I remember RSL, where the opponent really tried to attack down the Rapids left flank when Georgi Mihailovic was in a wide role and Sam Vines was there. And if you're so consistently attacking one side of the field, I have to wonder if that comes down to you think that that is the opponent scouts the Rapids and thinks that is the weakest entry point in terms of creating chances in the final third. And how can that not be an indictment on your left back? And I think that was exemplified, Mark. I think it was in the second half where Vines saw a ball come towards him and he kind of dummied it or let it go because maybe he thought somebody else was getting to it. And Wolf, the winger for NYCFC, ends up catching up to it and then shoots the ball into the side netting. And if he had gone the other side, I think there was some space that Zach Steffen had left open on the far post had he picked it out. And so not only, Mark, are we not seeing the offensive production that we're used to from Sam Vines, or at least getting into the midfield to contribute to the build-up play for that, but we've seen moments where he has looked less than solid defensively, and I think that's worth pointing out. And I think a lot of other things that are going on around the Rapids is papering over that particularly curtail. Not necessarily a bad thing, Mark, but maybe just a measured approach. I think, Rabbi, we could almost do we could have a podcast segment or an entire episode dedicated to Kevin Cabral, similar to our 2019-2020, I can't remember what year, we did like the great Diego Rubio debate where we spent 45 minutes debating why is Diego Rubio and whether or not he was good or overrated. And ultimately, Mark, I feel similarly about that, in that the people who weren't sold on Rubio at that time, and that was before he had his real breakout season with the first team, it had to have been going into 2019 because he scored double digits in 2019. Basically, fans said the exact same thing, but in a different order. So it was like if you were down on Rubio, said, okay, yes, he does X, Y, and Z good, but here's what he doesn't do well, A, B, and C wise. And then I feel like, so that's if you didn't like Rubio. If you liked Rubio at the time, you started with acknowledging the bad things, but then praising the good things on the back end. And I feel like we're getting to that point with Kevin Cabral, Mark. He's really, really fast. He does a lot of really great stuff in transition. He is able to pass almost every single outside back, third center back that he is matched up against, and he is able to get space, stay on side, and make it really easy for somebody on the ball to get it to him in space, transit to help the Rapids transition from defending in their final third, just having the ball in a good area in the final third. Once he gets to the final third, unless it's a really simple pass to someone who is wide open, he is not particularly useful. And there's absolutely no finish when it comes to him actually shooting the ball towards goal and actually putting it on goal. Every single goal that he has scored for the Colorado Rapids has either been a tap-in into a completely empty net, or there was the fortuitous bounce he had in Leagues Cup last year where Andrew Gutman did all of the work and Cabral just happened to be in the perfect position for the ball to go off of him and fortuitously roll past the Nashville goalkeeper. Kevin Cabral cannot score unless there is a wide open net in front of him, Mark, and no goalkeeper or defender remotely in his way. And so I'm done debating whether or not Kevin Cabral is for good or bad. We know that he's not going to get bought out or anything. I'm simply just going to acknowledge there is something that very
clearly... Wait, we know that?
I will believe it when it happens, Mark. I will believe
because
it when
the league gave a second buyout. I have like this glimmer of hope that they're going to buy him out this summer, but
stop
it's
it.
Just a glimmer. It really
stop
is.
It. Stop it. So I think just like I'm at the point, Mark, where I am objective towards I'm objective towards Kevin Cabral and anything. The glass is not half full. The glass is not half empty. The glass is half. Kevin Cabral is half, and the half that he is that he's really good in build-up play and in transition, getting into good areas, taking on defenders, striking the fear in God in them, and then getting the ball to somebody else to have them do all the work once the Rapids are set up in the attack in the final third. And as long as he's doing that, he is a useful cog in the Chris Armas machine, and he should start, and we should start him with the understanding that that is what he is going to be, and he's going to be nothing more. Mark, we did not criticize Danny Wilson. We were Danny Wilson apologists. And why? Because we acknowledged what Danny Wilson was, and he was good at two or three things. We didn't criticize him for not being Virgil van Dijk or Aaron Long or Miles Robinson. We acknowledged what he was good at, and when he was bad at something, we criticized him. And everything else was fundamentally how the rest of the team was set up for him to succeed. The team can be set up for Kevin Cabral to succeed. It just also lends to Kevin Cabral not providing the assist or the goal attempt on goal. Mark, let's talk about Omir Fernandez, who had a different role. He was wide at times. He was doing more link-up play. He was almost like in an eight mark, to where I would say at times, if this midfield looked like a three-man midfield, it was Oli Larraz in the six, Cole Bassett in the 8-6, and then Omer Fernandez in the 8-10. And I really think that it suited him. And I thought he was almost like his space and his movement and how he went about moving around in the system, similar to Cabral, I almost think it felt more natural to his skill set, and it was better suited for him to be the, he was the piano carrier Mark, not the piano player. And so I feel that way about Cabral. I feel that way about Omer Fernandez. And so I'm wondering if this is a position that will work for him. And we'll get to this with Big Thing, but I thought it was a masterstroke by Chris Armas to plan, have a tactical approach given the nature of the field and the opponent and the knowledge he had about that opponent, and then also understanding what Omer Fernandez was good at. And while Omer has not found the finishing touch in the final third in the box in the way that a Calvin Harris, a Cole Bassett, or Rafael Navajo has, he had the perfect skill set for the system that they wanted to have that was certainly advantageous and filled in the role that was missing by Georgi Mihajlovic for me. Mark, last thing that I'll say, 25 minutes, 14 seconds on the clock. I don't know how we haven't brought this up previously, Rabbi, but Kevin Cabral appears to beat the offsides trap on the ball getting switched to the other side of the field, I believe off the top of my head by Omer Fernandez, and then he squares it to Keegan Rosenberry, who's on running, and Keegan Rosenberry buries it, and the flag goes up, Mark, and it was called offside on the field. VAR supposedly had a check and confirmed the check. I have been tweeting back and forth with soccer photogrammetry, aka a nice guy, at offside model I. Mark, I'm sure you've seen this account where he will take screenshots of MLS games. He knows the dimensions of the field. He knows where in the stadium the cameras are. And in that, he is able to triangulate and account for the angle being somewhat misleading or the angle not being 180 degrees or perpendicular to the actual play, the offside line that is presented by the defense in order to estimate whether or not a player is onside or offside and by how much. And in some of these models, some of these estimates, Mark, he even puts it down to single digit number of inches that are available. And so I've tweeted back and forth with him. He said that it's on his list. He has not had time. The replay that showed, Mark, that is the most definitive for me, it's really, really close. It's within a foot, absolutely. For me, Kevin Cabral appears to be slightly onside. Darren Yapi, from all the replays that we've seen, is clearly offside, and so maybe that confused the AR. There's a possibility, Mark, that the AR is saying Yapi is offside and affecting the player, what the defense can do, and therefore calling it indirect offside, even though Yapi does not touch the ball on the play. Or does he think that by the narrowest margin, Kevin Cabral is offside, and could VAR not find that it was clear and obvious that he wasn't? Mark, did you see the play? What did you think about it? I know we've talked about referees the last couple weeks on the show. I think it's so close to call, I'm giving the benefit to the official. But did you think he was onside? And should Keegan Rosenberry have gotten his first goal of the season?
I mean, I'll give soccer photogrammetry the benefit of the doubt. If he thinks it was onside, then it was onside. That's pretty much simple to me. I just kind of accepted the call on the play because I am an idiot and I simp for the referees. I mean, I just basically I just go with them.
I think it's too close to call, Mark, and I agree with you in that I think we should give the benefit of the doubt to the official, who in theory was in the best position to make that call.
Yeah, but I'm with you, but going back a comment, I'm with you on the kind of Kevin Cabral kind of being a nothing burger again in a frustrating way, Sam Vines being a little bit out of sorts and not quite finding his feet, although I do think he did a pretty good job containing Messi in the game the Rapids played against Inter Miami. And they've had a couple games like that where I've seen Sam defend very well. But, you know, Sam's done his Vinesbacky thingy a little bit, and it hasn't really come to fruition yet. So we'll see how that plays out. And your Omer Fernandez comment was really great because, you know, I think one of the interesting things about watching a soccer game is that there are players that kind of stand out to me and players who I'm just, my brain kind of like tunes out and I'm just not noticing when they're kind of doing really good things on the ball. And Fernandez didn't jump out at me as a player who's having a particularly great game, maybe because he didn't wound up on the score sheet with an actual numerical contribution. But I've really liked him in general for the Rapids. I like what he adds. I like his lateral movement. I like kind of his guile and his ability to kind of kind of like be on the ball. I think the biggest challenge I've seen with Omer Fernandez in the collection of games I've had him is he hasn't seen a lot of the ball, which means he's not putting himself in position to show to receive enough. And I think also his passing has been a little bit either inaccurate or not aggressive or progressive enough for me.
Fair.
Which is like he wants to go east west when I think the team needs a little bit more of a north south. And I think I'm gonna grade on like the most ridiculous, unmatchable curve in the world, but like when you see the way Lionel Messi picks out a pass, or when you see the way even Oli Larraz on a diagonal ball to Cabral, or when you see some of the more advanced players in the league who say, I can unlock something with a pass. Like, that's kind of what we need at a position like that. If Fernandez isn't going to be blazingly fast, or if he isn't going to be Darlington Nagbe unpossessible, like a guy who's just locked down with the ball and you can't get it off him, then he's got to find kind of a plus-plus asset to his game. And my guess would be that kind of like sending in that really killer ball is the way to go. By the way, this is a problem that I'm going to go blast from the past names for you back to 2017. But this is a problem that Mohamed Saeed also had.
Yes.
Mohamed Saeed didn't have the straight out foot speed to beat guys on the wing. He did not have the size or the physicality. And he wasn't a lockdown dribbler. Like, his possession was good, but not elite. But he could unlock a team with a pass. We didn't see it as much as, enough to make him like a full-time MLS player for a decade. But like, that was his one thing. And he had a couple passes in his career where I was like, where did that come from? So that's where I want Omer Fernandez.
Speaking of Darlington Nagbe, did you see that post that went semi-viral about him with his 4 MLS Cup rings?
No, what was this?
Oh, so he posted his 4 MLS Cup rings marked. So it was Portland Timbers, Atlanta United, and the 2 Columbus Crew rings, which were, one was pre-rebrand and then one was post-rebrand. And so, Mark, if you look at it on his 4 fingers, they actually spell out taco. So, because you've got the T for Timbers, you've got the A for Atlanta, and then you've got the new Crew logo, which is the letter C, and then the old Crew logo, the more like Borussia Dortmund one, that is just a circle, so it's effectively an O. So the way Darlington Nagbe wears his MLS Cup rings, albeit with the Columbus ring switched chronologically from index finger to ring finger, it spells out taco, which is,
I'm looking
fantastic.
It up right now. That's incredible. He goes to a Mexican restaurant and he just flashes his rings for his order. I'll have 3 of these.
Yes, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So all stuff that I agree with, Mark, I'll go to big things on this. So, Rabbi, the one thing that I'm kind of worried about this game, or the one thing that I found intriguing about it, was the tactical approach and how different it was. And it was a unique tactical approach for a circumstance that won't be frequent for the Rapids this season. As Mark is pulling up the photo in question of Nagbe with the taco, MLS Cup rings. I'll put a link to that in the show notes to the Twitter post that I retweeted on that, listeners. But so, Mark, we know that the Rapids are not going to play on a pitch this size the rest of the season, right? And we know that the Rapids are also not going to play. There are teams that the Rapids are going to play that Chris Armas does not have as good of a tactical understanding of. There are teams in MLS that he didn't coach again most recently, or teams that he didn't have such a singular focus on as he would have had for NYCFC, in the same way, Mark, that I have to imagine, for many reasons, Pablo Mascherini is very, very in tune to what the Colorado Rapids are doing and has a very specific game plan in the scouting and the approach to a Rocky Mountain Cup game against the Rapids as the head coach of Real Salt Lake. And so I just have to wonder, was this a one-off because they came out in a 4-4-2, and at times it looked like a 4-2-2-2, and then at times also with Cole Bassett moving up very rarely in possession, it looked like a 4-1-3-2, which was a little bit different. You had Yapi starting up top with Rafael Navajo in a two striker position, which is something Armas has told me that he's thought about, he's want to implement. But is this a sometimes tactic, Mark, or is this an evolution of his idea and the system that he wants to implement that is a variation of or a departure from the 4-2-3-1 that we have seen? And so I have to imagine that Armas, understanding what NYCFC is, coaching so many games at a baseball stadium, having Omer Fernandez, who's an absolute NYCFC killer, and devising a game plan specifically for that, with that key linchpin player coming over from the Red Bulls to play a critical role in the middle, in and around the pitch for it, that it was just so specific, Mark, that it's not relevant to the other games that they're playing. Whereas we saw against FC Dallas, for example, Mark, we were both critical of Armas's tactical approach and the way the club responded after going up 2-0 against FC Dallas a couple weeks ago. We were critical of the initial approach and the response to FC Cincinnati when they go down, how they started the game, when they went down 1-0, and then really up until they went down 2-0, at which point you see the line change and Bombito scores that goal to make that game 2-1. And so I wonder, the thought of, oh, Armas knew exactly what the opponent was going to do and he changed the tactics and it wasn't necessarily what NYCFC were expecting and every single player was perfectly in position to have a great performance. Moise Bombito, Oliver Larraz, Cole Bassett, Omer Fernandez. Is that such a specific case because of the opponent and the nature and the team that they had that that was a lightning in a bottle situation and that's not necessarily replicable? Are there going to be other games where Armas isn't as prepared or as familiar with the opponent and the skill set of the Rapids players that he has available will not be able to have this perfect game plan specifically geared towards that opponent? That's one minor concern that I have. But Mark, we could see a flat 4-4-2 this coming week against San Jose, and it could be a little bit more possessive and up front. So then maybe it's a 4-2-2-2, and this is just part of Chris Armas's plan all along, and it was just dependent on a few things getting put in place. And this is one of the two main ways that the Rapids are going to attack, and it's going to be really, really great. And Armas has all of these great tactical ideas, and it wasn't just a one-off situation.
I'll just say really quick on the 4-4-2. There's one whole thing we didn't talk about in this whole thing, which was the words Darren Yapi did not come out of our mouths, because he wasn't bad. He just wasn't particularly, he didn't have a big contribution. And I think the other thing that I'll say about MLS Apple broadcasts is that every week they say the same thing. Like, young Darren Yapi, will he get on the score sheet this week? And it's like, we're really tired of hearing that. We're kind of past the point where we need to see a final product from Darren Yapi. There's a lot of bad luck there. He's clearly a talented kid. He's big and physical. He can get to balls, but if you can't finish and you're a striker in the rest of the organized world, in the growth of soccer, by the way, I don't know if you know this about kids, maybe you've read this too and heard this too, but like in all of the things that I've seen, like if you have a talented 9-year-old, he's really, really good at soccer. He's your striker, probably. Maybe he's your attacking mid, but most teams will make him your striker, okay? As that kid gets older, as they wind up on teams with other talented kids, they will often get moved back. They will get moved to wing, they will get moved to midfield, and like a lot of kids who start as striker end up as center backs. Like Mikel Williams told me, when he started as a player, he was a striker, and he still thinks of himself as a striker.
Mark, what Rapids homegrown, current homegrown on the team, was a striker in their initial year in the Rapids Academy? Current first team signed starting homegrown was a striker their first year in the Rapids Academy.
Don't think it would be Vines.
It was so, Sam Vines.
What? That doesn't yes. bag. That is surprising. But anyways, like, but yeah, but that's what I'm, not to belabor the point, but like, I'm not saying Darren Yapi needs to be moved to center back, but like, a striker who doesn't score any goals and is big and physical and fast, that's kind of Moise Bombito. Like, what if it was a Darren Yapi Moise Bombito center back pairing? That's not a terrible idea. Now, that being said, like,
Burgundy Forest.
This is kind of what happened when Jossy Zardes was having a terrible year for the Galaxy and they moved him to right back. Like, that. But that being said, like, that was basically a half a season decision because they were like, you know, we need to do something with this guy and we're paying him a bunch of money. Let's see if he can be right back. You know, like, that's a challenge. By the way, on a related note, we said this a couple weeks ago when Dylan Cerner retired, but like that was one of the challenges with Dylan Cerner, which is we don't think he ever found his right position. If Yapi can't score, maybe he needs to find another position.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say, Mark, and then we can move along with this podcast. But to my point about how this was such an outlier in terms of the Rapids approach and in terms of the nature of the game due to the opponent and where the game was being played, that I wonder if it's an outlier. How useful is this data point in the macro 34 game season for the Colorado Rapids? I also have to wonder, Mark, with the way that the tactical approach was and how seamlessly every single player understood and executed on their role, Darren Yapi notwithstanding, maybe Sam Vines in a few moments as well. I also have to wonder, Mark, we found something in which the attack was free-flowing and everybody seemed to be working harmoniously and no one individual was a clogged things up. This was also the game without Georgi Mihailovic. I wonder, in a flat 4-4-2, I don't know what position Georgi Mihailovic plays, because you're not upending Cole and Ollie in the double pivot. Do you move him out wide left and lose the verticality that you have from Evan Cabral? Or is this a formation that doesn't necessarily work for him? And where would, I would assume you would put Georgi either underneath the strikers if you have Yapi, or maybe you have Cabral as a striker, or you would put him as the second striker with Rafael Navajo if you're going with the 4-2-2-2. And so this is a wonderful data point, Mark, that I think will be worth consideration for Chris Armas and the coaching staff to look at. It's not clear to me where you fit Georgi in, and given the concerns that we've had about Georgi, I don't know that this system works for them, and maybe that just necessitates moving back to the 4-2-3-1, which has pre-existing issues that we've talked about for last month on this podcast. I will have an article out for Burgundy Wave on this, folks. I won't spoil the nuance or the punchline from it, but that underlies and is a precursor to why I'm saying that. Mark, anything else about this game, or shall we put it to bed?
We have said a lot about this game.
Mark, tell our dear listeners how they can best support Holding the High Line so that we can buy more bagels with Schmear.
Bagels with Schmear. And fake lightsabers. Listeners, you are the support to our podcast. You are the thing that keeps the machine humming along on its rails. We really appreciate you. We are supporter reporters. We are citizen soccer journalists, and we do this out of the love of our own hearts while working actual regular day jobs. So in order to help Matt and me get out to training a little bit more often, to pay for the ink and our quills and our parchment, if you want to chip in and buy us a beer every once in a while, we would really appreciate it. The best way to do that is to become a supporting Highliner. That is being a member of the hthl.substack.com at the paid level. That's $48 for the year, $5 for the month, $96 at the Gallery of Honor plan. We'd really appreciate it. Additionally, we're running a special. You can buy the t-shirt from Holding the High Line leftover merch. I'm going through the pile tomorrow to figure out what all the sizes are. I'll be sending out a form for anyone who's interested to see what we've got. We've got lots of the camo grays left. You can wear it. It's great for running. It's great for exercise. Summer's coming. It's very light. It is moisture wicking. It is really pleasant on the skin. It's great with a cool breeze. Highly recommended. And you could rep it at the gym and everyone will say, hey, what is that very bewitching crest on the front of your chest there, my man? And we'll say, oh, that there? That's just the best podcast in all of North America. That's Holding the High Line with Rabbi in the Red. Holding the High Line. So if you'd like to support us, that'd be great. Otherwise, just like and subscribe on the socials. We're on Facebook. We're on X. Just being a free subscriber to the Substack helps boost our numbers and is good for us. So if you want to support us with moral support, you can also send us an email and say, thanks for doing all the great job you do, or just retweet or repost our Facebook-y type stuff. We'd appreciate it. Back to you, Matt.
Mark, we won't spend a whole lot of time on this, but Tim Howard was officially inducted in over the weekend to the U.S. Soccer Hall of Fame. We featured the audio from the media press availability from a couple weeks ago on this podcast feed. So if you have not listened to that episode from Saturday midday, I would encourage you to go back and listen to it. So we give Tim his flowers. Mark, we did a really good tribute for Tim in 2019, which was the second season of this podcast after his final home game of the season. Mark, I don't know if you remember that. I think it was a 2-0 win over FC Dallas, and we saw some vintage Tim Howard saves and had some good audio from post-game availability, and we gave him, you know, some flowers when we talked about it afterwards before we previewed that LAFC game that saw the Rapids narrowly miss out on the playoffs. So if you want to relive that, go back and scroll through the annals of our history. If you're having trouble getting back into the archives to find that, feel free to get in touch with me and I can send you the old Blueberry link to that. That should still be live, or I'll send you the MP3. I have it on my external hard drive if you really want that. So, but Mark, Tim Howard, U.S. Soccer Hall of Fame, the U.S. Soccer Hall of Fame social media put out some really good stuff from his speech. He was inducted by Rapids goalkeeper coach Chris Sharp. Sharpie, Mark, his son is, Tim Howard is the godfather to Chris Sharpie's son, which speaks to the relationship that they have. And there was some other good stuff posted out on social by the U.S. men's national team, by the Rapids. I haven't looked at Everton's Twitter feed, but I have to imagine they posted out. Mark, Tim Howard got his flowers, and I think it's worthwhile saying that part of his soccer journey was being a captain of the Colorado Rapids and a really, really good person, leader, and star for the Burgundy Boys under Robin Fraser and Anthony Hudson.
Yeah, I mean, his contribution to the Colorado Rapids was an excellent 2016 year, which we will forever remember as the last time this team won a playoff game. But also just... it was great that the Colorado Rapids hooked a big name and kind of elevated the club for a year. You know, the Colorado Rapids will be forever known in Major League Soccer as the team of Marcelo Balboa and slightly more briefly, Tim Howard. And I think that that's also like a kind of a funny mark on his career, which is he's one of the greatest American soccer players of all time. He will mostly be remembered for his time at Everton, for his time at Manchester United, for his time with the U.S. men's national team, slightly less after that as a New York, New Jersey Metro star, and then on the bottom of that list as a Colorado Rapids. So, I think, you know, overwhelmingly, the most enduring contribution that anyone will ever remember about Tim Howard was how he stood on his head in the game against Belgium. In one of the most epic performances by a goaltender of all time. That is just so enjoyable, and that just warms me to no end. And if that game came on, I don't know if you have this channel, Matt, but you know, if you have crappy rabbit ears or basic internet connection TV, you get the FIFA channel. And the FIFA channel is only running old soccer games, and they love to run old World Cup games. I would say that if USA Belgium came on at any moment or any time, I would stop everything that I was doing and watching it because of what Tim Howard did that day. And that's a pretty strong endorsement of not only that one game, but the man's entire body of work. He was one of the most exceptional goalkeepers in goalkeeper history and in American goalkeeper history.
Go back and, listeners, if you were not following the team in 2016, go back and watch that penalty shootout against the LA Galaxy in which Tim Howard helps, as you said, Mark, helps the Rapids advance. And that was the last time the Colorado Rapids advanced in a playoff round in the MLS Cup playoffs. Mark, this coming Saturday, May 11th, the Colorado Rapids are back at home, back into our loving arms at the Richard, where they will be playing their second game against the San Jose Earthquakes of the 2024 season. So, Mark, the Rapids are now sitting in fifth in the Western Conference, 18 points off of 11 games played. There are some teams around them that are only on 10 games played. In any case, the Pids have a record of 5-3-3 and a positive goal difference, a goal difference of +3. And at home this year, they are 2-1-1. San Jose Earthquakes still in the bottom of the Western Conference. They have 7 points off of 11 games played. They have a record of 2-8-1 and a goal difference of -9. And away from PayPal Park, they are 0-5-1. Since the last time the Rapids played San Jose, Mark, it's been less than a month. It was April 13th that they played. They then lost in the Cali Clasico to LA Galaxy. That was in a 4-3 game. Galaxy did have a red card in that match. They got a gritty performance in which they were underwhelming or were the lesser team in a 1-1 draw against Nashville SC. And this past weekend, Mark, the Earthquakes defeated San Jose, defeated LAFC by a score of 3-1 in the MLS WTF game of the week, Mark. That was a goal from Rodriguez and Pellegrino, who we talked about when the Rapids played San Jose a few weeks ago. Mark, can you guess that Dennis Bawanga, did he score a goal or score an own goal in that game, Mark?
I think own. No. Well, there was 3-1, so own goal?
No, it was Christian Oliveira that scored in the 59th minute. And 10 minutes prior to that, Dennis Bawanga got an own goal that made it 3-0 as well. So was that the crazy chaos game of the weekend, Mark? Was that the MLS scriptwriters deciding that they needed to keep MLS fans on their toes? Did the San Jose Earthquakes finally put up or shut up? Or did LAFC lay an egg against a bad team on the road that was in desperate need of a home win? We've seen that more than once this season, for example. So those are the questions I have going into San Jose. Mark, we won't talk too much about their roster because we talked about them just a couple weeks ago. It should point out that William Yarbrough was in goal for this game, so I'm not sure what's going on at the goalkeeper position, Mark. But there's a very real possibility that the big MF-er in the goal will be back at Dick's Sporting Goods Park as the starter for San Jose. And since last we podcasted, the primary transfer window closed, Mark, and the big talk for the Quakes going into that game against the Rapids and then coming out of that game also was whether or not they were finally going to spend to try and help the attack, help Jeremy Abobasi, help Christian Espinoza, and they have brought that in on April 25th. They signed Argentinian midfielder Hernan Lopez to be a designated player. I believe a club record transfer fee reportedly of $6 million. And then there was also what else did they do? They did some roster finagling in order to open up that DP slot. Hernan Lopez comes in, 23-year-old, Mark, real number 10 player, Argentinian. He was previously playing at Godoy Cruz, a Argentinian club that I have not previously heard of. He's a product out of the River Plate Academy, so presumably he is decent, Mark. So San Jose spent big money on an attacking midfielder, Mark. They're still mostly playing in a 4-3-3. Lopez was a substitute in that game against LAFC and came on in the 46th minute. And then if I open up his stats, I think he had one shot. He had 3 key passes, 13 passes as well. And I don't believe, let me check on the stats here, was he involved in any of the goals that were scored? Christian Espinoza had the primary assist on the 2 goals that were scored by the Rapids, and I haven't seen the replay of the Dennis Bawanga own goal, Mark, so I don't know if that was Lopez firing a shot off and it just happened to take a touch off of Bawanga and into the net, like how we would say, like how we describe, Mark, that the 2 own goals that, or the potentially 2 own goals that were scored by the Rapids against FC Dallas were earned in that the Rapids created opportunities that led to the own goals committed by the 2 Dallas players. Cole Bassett, great effort, created the opportunity. Calvin Harris shot on goal, created an opportunity. So I don't know about that. But so, Mark, presumably this is an attacking player who, even if he's a substitute at altitude, I have to imagine that he's got 45 minutes in him for the San Jose Earthquakes. And that's the one big change. That being said, he's a new player around a new team that is still trying to dig their way out of the basement in the MLS Western Conference. And the big question I have, Mark, is whether or not that game against LAFC was a blip or a trend. I imagine if the Rapids attack San Jose Earthquakes with the level of tenacity they've had in the last 2 home games and the approach that they had against NYCFC, this is a game that the Rapids should win. This is a game that a playoff team would win and win comfortably. Rabbi, your thoughts?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think Amal Pellegrino hasn't been as has shown that he has the potential and can be better than this. I think the biggest challenge, so they have added all the players that they need. This new addition of Lopez, that they, Hernan Lopez from Godoy Cruz that you mentioned, that's a big move. He came on in the 46th. He started the second half, covering for Jack Skahan. And this he only played 45 minutes, and a lot of people, including Tom Bogert over at MLS, over at, the Athletic, noted that, he made an instant improvement, that he's really a high end player, that he's an, that he think, they think that this is a change, a sea change in the team. I think the critical thing with San Jose is that the back line did not improve, and they're leaking goals like crazy. So this is going to be an interesting game for the Rapids because they are going to need to produce as much offense as they did before. Defensively, they may be at sixes and sevens in this game. They will be pushed, I think, a little bit more by a strong offensive team. I just want to note that one of the things that I experienced when I was in San Jose covering that last game was that I really did feel like San Jose missed some very obvious opportunities. There were a few moments in the game where I was like, how did they miss that? And I was shocked that there wasn't more howling in the press box from the San Jose media because they missed some really, really open chances. I don't think they're going to keep doing that. You never know. I also think the Rapids getting lucky against a team that's missed open chances 2 weeks in a row is not great. That being said, Colorado's very strong at home. My recollection against San Jose is that they've typically been very good against San Jose at home. And that's going back to when I first started covering the Rapids in 2015. So it's a lot of fun. I think this game is probably going to go the Rapids way, but I wouldn't rule out a draw. I'm going to go with 2-2. I'm going to call this a 2-2 draw. I think that Colorado's been overachieving a little bit, and maybe there'll be some coming back to earth. San Jose's been underachieving a little bit, and maybe they'll pull it together.
I'm going to go 2-1 in this game, Mark. I do think that, you know, San Jose had opportunities against the Rapids, particularly after the Rapids scored a goal in this reverse fixture. So I think Christian Espinoza is going to be up for it. I can't imagine that Jeremy Obobese, in terms of his finishing and work in the box, can be any worse than he was against Colorado back on April 13th. And so I think Pellegrino, I think San Jose has the attacking style of players that suit. And if they play the way that they did against the Rapids without having a really poor start and conceding a goal in the opening minutes, they'll be able to get opportunities. And this time, they will progress back to the mean and be able to score. We'll see whether or not Hernan Lopez has a role in that. Mark, let's put some names on some goal scorers. I think Navajo gets another goal on this one. He has to be absolutely flying after this one. And I think we see, I'll say we get an Andreas Maxu goal off of corner as well, Mark. I think the Rapids continue to create opportunities on set pieces, and I thought they were very dangerous in that game against San Jose. They just didn't finish. I think we're going to see that Quakes defense focus in on Moise Bombito and Rafael Navajo on those corners, and that's going to leave Maxu open. And like you said, their defense has been struggling as well. So I think the Great Dane scores and keeps things going for the Burgundy Forest when it comes to corner opportunities. Mark, give me your Rapids goal scorers.
You are not gonna stop until Burgundy Forest is a thing. Stop trying to make Burgundy Forest a thing. No, I like it. It's growing on me. My goal scorers in this match are gonna be Cole Bassett because he is on a roll, baby. He is hitting it. And every year, Keegan Rosenberry plugs one blistery shot from outside of the box for a goal. Sometimes he has one that doesn't quite make it, and he goes a year or two without him. But that's my pick, is that this is the game that Keegan Rosenberry puts it away.
Mark, if Georgi Mihailovic is fit and ready to play and everything, do you go back to, if you're Chris Armas, do you go 4-4 or 4-2-3-1, or do you keep the tactical approach against that you had against NYCFC?
I mean, Mihailovic is in ink in the lineup sheet, no matter, as long as he's healthy. I think the guy that I would pull off is Kevin Cabral. He stretches the field because of his speed, but I think there are other things that you can get from some of, I think Calvin Harris does that too. So I think there are other things that you can get if you slot in Omer Fernandez, or if maybe you return Cole Bassett up to the front three and then put, now that we've seen Jasper Lofelson is healthy, you maybe start Jasper Lofelson as one of the deep lying guys back there. So there's one other option here which the Rapids could go to, which is we haven't seen five at the back this year. And I think when you have Lofelson, who's a capable fullback type player, and Keegan Rosenberry, who really plays like a ball-playing center back, you could use Lofelson wide as in kind of an overlapping fullbacks thing. I think the other thing, I'm not expecting it. I think Chris Armas is very wedded to a 4-2-3-1. But I do think as a manager, sometimes you want to show different looks to opposing teams and throughout the league and to your own team so that you can say, you know, let's try things. Let's shake things up. Let's be unpredictable. I think actually, you know, when you're game planning against the Colorado Rapids at Colorado and you watch tape and you watch them do the 4-2-3-1 and you know how they're going to come out and you know which spaces they're going to overload and which spaces you're going to be able to exploit, like that becomes a disadvantage. Like being predictable becomes a disadvantage. So occasionally, maybe Chris Armas might want to shake things up. I know that we really haven't seen Keegan Rosemary come inside as a center back. I know that the default might position there might be to go to one of the other center backs on the bench, like Lalas Abubakar, who is probably, you know, growing rust back there, or Nate Jones, who hasn't had a chance yet. But it's a thought, and I like the idea of shaking things up, especially when you've kind of generated a degree of success and you're comfortably in fifth place in the Western Conference. And at this point, you're just kind of trying to make sure you keep things going. Just a thought. Okay, hey, Chris, Mark, if you're listening, consider it.
Yeah. Let's get to some
link three times if you're listening.
Let's get to some rapid fire Ask HTHLs. Rabbi, first of all, Smasher X Smash, or Smasher by Smash, I'm not sure. Smasher asks, hopefully at LWS Matt Pollard will make an Ask HTHL about the Diok question next week. Perhaps Chris needs a good grilling about that too. So, Mark, we saw, I don't have in front of me what minute Diak came in, but Lamine Diak was a substitute. At one point, it was him and Jasper Lofelson in for the team, and we continue to see that he is a player the Rapids are paying a lot of money as a TAM player. He is a player the Rapids have to make a significant financial decision on come the end of July, and he continues to be nothing more than a late-game substitute, and a late-game substitute despite there being moments prior to his stepping onto the field in which
87th minute, Matt.
87th minute, thank you. So, you know, effectively, you know, end of the game after the second goal scored by Cole Bassett in this game. And so,
and Kamani Stewart played in this game. I didn't even notice.
Oh, yeah. Hi, KSB. Did you see his cornrows, Mark?
I didn't even notice that he played, so therefore I didn't notice that he had cornrows.
Okay, yeah, KSB has now had, he's now up to three different hairstyles, three different hair looks. He had a fro in preseason, and then he had, like, this, like, braid into like two pigtails on the front that I've seen as well. He had that for an R2 game, and now he's got straight cornrows. So
I'm bald. I wish I had one hairstyle.
Okay, so he's changing up. In any case, Mark, I continue to wonder what's going on from a personnel standpoint with Lamine Diok, and something in there is not right. That might not necessarily be the fault of the player or the fault of the coaching staff. Ollie Ross has been fantastic. Chris Armas has found something in the midfield pairing that we've seen from him and Cole Bassett. And when something is working and something is leading to results, I can completely understand Chris Armas as a meritocratic coach, that's not something that he wants to change. And in that regard, that's unfortunate for Lamine Diok. We'll see, Mark, whether or not, you know, Connor Ronan was back more involved in team training on Friday. We'll see whether or not he's available for selection finally on Saturday. I think he might still be a week away, but in any case, I think that both of those players have done enough to where you say it's your guys' job until you prove that you can't do it or there's a situation in which we need you to play elsewhere. But yeah, I think that on some level lends to that either the timing for Diok did not work or that Diok is not as good as the coaching staff thought based on, or that the scouting team found a player and the front office decided to sign him. And based on the front office assigned a value to that player based on the scouting. And that value was shown in the fact that they're paying him TAM. So they think he's better than Ronan. They think he's better than Oliver Ross. They think he's better than Jasper Lofelson. He's taking up international roster slot. You have an option to buy him, and that could be more than $1 million. Possibly, I haven't been able to confirm that. And so if you think that he's worth a significant transfer fee in TAM, he has to be good. He's not starting. What isn't working here? And is that the scouting team? Is that the front office and getting caught up and excited about a player and over-evaluating him in the acquisition of him? Is that the player coming in and not secretly being as good? Is it just bad timing? Or is Ali Larraz the future TAM midfielder that we want him to be? And if that case, Mark, I'd rather send Diak back to his loan option and get in another guy with an option to buy on TAM at another position of need, if that means that Ale the Raz is becoming the ginger god midfielder that I've been waiting for him to become for the last 2 or 3 years. But yeah, look, and to point out, so this Saturday, the Rapids are playing the Quakes. And then so after that, Mark, the Rapids play Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday. So starting this Saturday, in the next 3 weeks, the Rapids have 6 games in 3 weeks. I have to believe with that and the traveling that at some point we see more of Diak and we see Diak as a starter. And I hesitate to judge him until we see him in a proper game as a starter, not in a very specific game state that suits to his playing style. I've seen him in training. He looks good in training. Does he look better as an individual, regardless of who he's partnered up with, better than what Kolbasa and Ale the Raz have been? For me, no. But I trust Chris Armas on this. But yeah, this continues to be a weird situation. And Mark, the fact that we're complaining about a player not getting on the field as a Colorado Rapids homegrown is succeeding and being a part of the team winning games speaks to the fact that this is, for the moment, a champagne problem for the Colorado Rapids.
Yeah.
Mark, I got a question.
I don't have anything to add. I just wanted to add that point is like my main point is like, we're living in the best possible world, which is we signed a TAM level player who we thought we desperately needed. And we don't because we have this redheaded youth player who stepped off of R2 and is soaking up all the minutes. That's a great problem. These are the problems I want in my life.
There's a part of me that has to wonder, Mark, with how good Bombito and how good Ale the Raz are. Did they need last season figuring it out in order to get right? Or is
let's not sign any players anymore. Let's just bring up homegrowns and work through the draft. I'm just kidding. That hasn't worked in the past, but that's how good it's been this year.
Chris Armas is getting something out of these players that Robin Fraser refused to even attempt last year. That was the point I wanted to get to.
Well said.
Another topic for a later time, Mark. And then we've got two questions from @DraftPids. I'll throw the first one to you, Mark, since you would have been at least closer to the age cohort for this show, or at least dated a woman who has seen more of the show than I have. Which Rapids 96 player is visiting Carrie Bradshaw's apartment this week? #HDHL. Mark, the Rapids avoided the classic New York hangover game, flying in on Saturday, not going out Saturday night for a Sunday night kickoff or anything. But Mark, which Rapids player got the ire of Carrie Bradshaw with their performance on Sunday?
Well, Keegan Rosenberry is the only one who I think of as man enough for Carrie Bradshaw, but he strikes me as, I forget the name of the guy, but there was this kind of like laid back, kind of like upstate, chill, hiking dude, hippie guy. The actor was a guy who used to be on Northern Exposure, which was a show I really liked back in the day. But anyways, that's like Keegan's that kind of guy. Like nobody else, everybody else, like Miranda would take Cole Bassett back to her apartment and have his way with her, because Miranda was kind of more into the like New York Athletic Club towel boy, boy toy kind of college kid just graduated from NYU, Mrs. Robinson kind of relationship situation. But Carrie was definitely, you know, looking for a more stately, mature guy. By the way, Carrie Bradshaw's like perfect take would have been Tim Howard. She would really would have loved a big, burly, you know, kind of strong man like that. I don't know if Carrie Bradshaw is woman enough to handle Tim Howard, but now we're getting into the kind of bluer aspect of this.
I'm going to be a very Samantha here, Mark, now. And interrupt you so that we can change the topic here.
Oh, thanks. Before we lose all our listeners.
Yes. I can't believe, Chris, I'm sorry you had to listen to this banter. Second question.
He asked.
I apologize to Chris Armas for us having to bring up Sex in the City. And then DraftPid's other question, Mark, asked simply, are we good? #HTHL. DraftPids, I think it is very clear that this past offseason, from a talent standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, players responding, the coaching staff and everything, that we have raised the floor of the Colorado Rapids. I think it is very clear the floor of this team is being on the bubble for the playoffs and narrowly missing out on the playoffs for me, unless something significantly changes in the summer transfer window. If Moise and Cole are sold to Europe, then I think we could reevaluate things. But so for now, I think the Rapids have clearly raised the floor. They are a team that absolutely should be expecting to make the playoffs. The question I have is, what is their ceiling? They've proven that they can get results in difficult situations where it's a 50-50 game, and if they execute and the other team doesn't, they can get results. They have proven when they play bad teams and they play well against bad teams, they can pick up results. Can the Rapids get good results against good teams? That will be the difference between them finishing 6th or 7th and then the finishing 4th or 5th, and that will then determine be the inputs upon which we evaluate and create expectations around them come the playoffs. But this team is fun. This team is playing together. This team is getting results, and you have every right to be proud and be happy of this football club right now and to have expectations that they will go in and play well and get a result against the San Jose Earthquakes, and that is a massive improvement on last year. Are they much better than 2023? Absolutely. Are they good? We think so. We need more information. Are they great? TBD. Listeners, you can follow us on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi, at LWS Matt Pollard, and at Rapids96Podcast. You can email us at Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com. You can send us your questions on the socials using the hashtag AskHTHL. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. And you can rate, review, share, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Just search wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll be able to find us. Tell other Rapids fans around about us as well. Mark, thank you so much for joining me. It was wonderful to see you. Happy return of the 6th. Enjoy this win against NYCFC, folks, and enjoy finally being back for a home game on Saturday at the Richard. Listeners, we'll see you next week. Burgundy peace.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.